Grant, well, welcome back, everybody. Thank you for returning. I always find that this is the time of day when I get the most agreement from people. You look around you about 10 minutes and you see people agreeing with me, you know. I've even had people agree with me permanently, you know, at this time. So we'll be gentle and move along. And we have a little, well, about 45 minutes or so to try to get down while we're done. I just want to pick up and kind of very briefly outline what I mean by this life to faith to life approach, and then we might try to practice a little bit of it. But in a sense, what we're proposing is that teaching any religion or any faith tradition, you need to engage students' lives with the real themes, the real issues of their lives. You need to give them access to the spiritual wisdom of a Christian tradition, a Muslim tradition, or whatever, a story, the story and vision as is pertinent. And then you've got to try to integrate them, invite them to integrate it and see for themselves. So in a sense, engage their lives, give them access to the spiritual wisdom and detail and data of a tradition of faith, and then ask them to put the two together to see for themselves what it might mean for their lives. Now, for years, I've talked about this, the shared Christian praxis approach, and that's another name for it. The life to faith to life is a more user-friendly way to describe it. And this book, Will There Be Faith, in a sense, favors the more non-technical language. It's actually a more readable book. But the shared Christian praxis approach, you can imagine this life to faith to life approach as engaging a focusing activity, kind of to get the thing started, an engaging activity, and then five pedagogical movements. And I call them movements because they're very flexible. They can get all mixed up. You don't have to always do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You can do 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 3, 5. They can mix and match, and they never quite turn out the way you think they're going to. They begin with a focusing activity, which engages a person with a real life or a life and faith theme. You can begin with people's real lives, or you can begin with some aspect of their faith life. One of my favorite, I don't teach much high school people or secondary school people anymore, but I often do demonstration lessons, and of course I write textbooks for them. But one of my favorite was having young people emerge, talk about who Jesus is for them. You could meditatively put them on the road to Caesarea Philippi, where Jesus asks the people, who do people say that I am? And then you say, well, who would you say? If you're on the road with Jesus, who would you say? In other words, you can begin with their own, but you're looking at not their theory of Jesus, but who Jesus is for them. So it could be a life, a real life, ordinary life, or it could be a life and faith theme can begin the curriculum. And then beginning with people's lives, in a sense, you invite them to express themselves, to talk about, to reflect on their own praxis, their own experience of the theme, much like Jesus on the road to Emmaus when he said to them, what are you talking about as you go upon your way? Movement two then is when you encourage their own reflection and their own conversation and reason and memory and imagination. In a sense, it really is getting them to tell their own story, although it may not be done in a narrative form. But you get them to look at life and reflect on it and question it and probe it and analyze it and think about it. And then you attempt to bring them then to the faith tradition. Now, very often, I will use some of the faith tradition as a focusing act, like my opening comments here this morning. You can mix and match. It's not a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but having got them to look at the theme, the generative theme, the interest, the praxis, the experience of their own lives, getting them to reflect upon it and talk about it and share that, whatever way they do. And again, at a high school level, they may not be ready to talk, so you get them to journal or put it in their books or whatever. But you get them somehow to express themselves around the theme, whatever it might be, as it is its experience in their own lives. And then you then give them access to the persuasive access, using reason and desire, to the story and vision of faith, whatever the tradition might be, according to the theme, according to the topic, according to the group, according to the context, and so on. And by that persuasive access, I would say, I had a wonderful professor at Columbia years ago, Philip Phoenix, God be good to him. And Philip Phoenix, the day he taught Hinduism, you'd swear he was a Hindu. The day he taught Buddhism, you'd swear he was a Buddhist. The day he taught Islam, you'd think he was a Muslim. Because he had a great respect for these traditions. He was well informed in them. And he would lay out why good people have found these traditions persuasive and life-giving for thousands of years. And you'd go away saying, I'm not going to be a Buddhist, but at least I have a deeper appreciation for Buddhism. And the day he did Judaism, you think he was a Jew. In fact, he was an ordained Presbyterian minister. He was a model to me of how to lay out great faith traditions as traditions of spiritual wisdom that people could learn from, whether it's their own confession or faith or not. But having given them access to a rich faith tradition, then movement four is moving back to life again. You encourage people's appropriation, their integration, what they're coming to see for themselves. And a lot of that can be, instead, typically as teachers, we tend to lay out what we're supposed to teach, and then we ask them, what did you hear? Tell me what I said. And in a sense, we grade them on what they feed back to us, how accurately they remember what we told them. Movement four is a lot, you want them to know what you said, but it's a lot more than that. You begin to ask them, what do you think yourself? Does that make any sense to you? Do you agree with that? Do you disagree with it? One of my favorite questions, even big doctoral students, is to say, what did you learn in school today? In other words, what did you learn? No, it's movement four. But you're looking for, it's like that moment on the road to Emmaus that you're hoping when they came to see, when they recognized him. So you ask them questions that encourage them to think for themselves, to make judgments about what you've taught, to make decisions perhaps. And the movement five then is a call. It's an invitation to decision. And the decisions can be cognitive, affective, can be behavioral. It can be their head, their heart, their hands, but at least you're asking them, what did you learn from that? How have you took it seriously? How would you put it to work? What difference might it make in your life? Supposing somebody really believed this, what difference do you think it would make? Inviting them to choose identity. Let me give a couple of examples, and then we're going to do one together. A favorite lesson I taught a couple of years ago now, I was invited to teach an eighth grade. So that's about like this, about the second year of high school with you, about the second year of secondary school. And I was doing something on their image of God. And God bless you. And how do you stop young people and get them thinking about what is my image of God? Because that's what you want to begin with. You don't want to begin with telling them what the church's image of God is. You want to begin with their own praxis of God. And anyway, my way of doing it, I told him the story of Michelangelo being appointed by Pope Leo III to paint God on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. And Michelangelo did the obvious thing, he ran away because he knew that no matter what he painted, it would be ridiculous. He'd be the laughing stock of his fellow artists. So I gave a little drama to it. But you didn't say no to Pope Leo. He sent the troops after him, and it was that or the stake. So Michelangelo reluctantly agreed to paint God and lay for, 3 years, 4 years on his back. And there it is ever since. And I show them a picture. We show them a picture where he painted. And then you say to them, now imagine you were Michelangelo and you had to paint God. What would you paint? And you could give them construction stuff, you could give them drawing paper, you could give them whatever they wanted to work with, or even to articulate, what is your image of God? If somebody asks you, what is your image of God? And it'll all come out, like a big old man with a white beard and all the typical social stereotypes we have of God. And they came right out, an old man with a beard and a kind old man, or Santa Claus, or what does he look like? And you get them talking about, thinking about, sharing together, perhaps, if there's confidence in the group, what their image of God is. And then you begin to ask them, now, how did you get that image? Where did you come by it? Who shaped it? That's movement two. My story about Michelangelo, then asking their own image of God. And as I said, you can give them construction paper and get them to draw, to paint, to rhythm, to play door, whatever they want to do. But then where did you get your image of God? Who shaped your image? Who told you who God is? And was it your granny, your grandmother? Who does your God look like? If you look at the face of this God, who does he remind you of? My father. Oh, do you like your dad? And why do you think God is like your dad? Well, he's kind of mad, I've had some very negative comments at a time like that too. But get them to probe where, and they can use reason, memory, or imagination. The imagination, now, how is that God? Is it a good God? Is that a good God for your life? Is it a positive God? Is it a helpful God? Is it a God who you could you believe that this God loves you? Imagination. Could you have any sense that this God is in love with you? That this God, this old man with a beard, if that's what you think God, who do you think God is? Could God be an old woman? could God be a grandmother? The old, the Sioux Indian, beautiful Indian, Sioux Indian tradition. God is a grandmother and holds us on our lap. Julian of Norwich, God holds us in her womb. The whole beautiful imaging of God out of the medieval mystics, Hildegard and Julian and these people, that God holds us lovingly in her womb. And you can begin to ask them imagination questions like that. Did you ever imagine God cuddling you in her arms, holding you in her womb? And they say, what? What the hell is he talking about? Jeez, you know. But you're trying to break open their images. Then the third movement is when you talk to them about who this God is. And I basically use the story of the prodigal son, because I think it's the core of the God that Jesus believed in, Luke chapter 15. And you go through that story with them, the young, we were talking about it over lunch, the prodigal that in many ways needed to go away in order to come to himself. But he remembers that in his father's house, that the workers were well paid. In other words, that the dad was a man of justice, and the mother. And I always think the mother sent the father out to be looking out over the horizon. And the amazing thing about that story is that, remember, the son is coming home with an apology ready. I'm not worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired servants. And the father, the text there says that his heart, when he sees the prodigal coming over the horizon, that it was filled with compassion. And the Greek word there means in his very bowels, that he felt it in his stomach. He had this extraordinary love and compassion for his prodigal returning. I always think it was the mother that sent him out to look for the child. And it was certainly the mother that prepared the party. And the father rushes out and embraces the son before the son apologizes. Now, in Mosaic law, the son never should have been welcome home. He'd forfeited his birthright. He ended up eating with pigs. He never should have been left back in the house. And not only does the father welcome him home, but he welcomes him home unconditionally, the unconditional love of God. That we could, there's nothing we can do, no matter what far country we go to. God will still love us and will welcome us home whenever we want to come home. I will embrace us lovingly. And they're sitting there wide-eyed. And you say, and the son then says, you know, but the father embraces him before he apologizes. What an unconditional love. The kid could have been home, coming home, what, looking for more money, get his laundry done, whatever. But the father, what a risk for the father. And then the father, not only does the father welcome him home, but actually promotes him within the family. The sandals and the shoes and the ring for his finger are all symbols of promotion within the family. And then you go on and on about that and the kind of a God we have and the kind of mercy God has for us and the kind of inclusion and hospitality. And you can tell the story of the second son, because the second son has his moment of rebellion too. And says, look, I've always done what I was told, and look, you never even gave me a kid goat to celebrate. And you can lay out that, but you're laying out the unconditional love of God. Now, the key is that in movement four then, you have to say to them, now what do you think? Has your image of God shifted anything? When you bring your talking and imaging of God to that story, and Jesus told it to try to tell us, that that's Jesus' ultimate story about the love and unconditional love of God and who God is for us. And we haven't exhausted the topic at all, but at least we've dipped in a little bit into the tradition. But does it shift your imaging of God? Like, how, if you took it seriously, if you believed it, what difference would it make? Like, can you believe this whole story of the prodigal son? Was Jesus just kidding? Was he pulling our leg? Or is there a God? Are we sinners? Are we sinners in the hands of an angry God? Or are we good people in the hands of a loving God? They're the two great divides of Christian tradition. Jonathan Edwards, the great Calvinist theologian, we're sinners in the hands of an angry God. Or Karl Rahner, we're good people in the hands of a loving God. People, and there's lots of variation, there's lots of midpoints between. Where are they going to come down? Why are you going to believe yourself? Where, on a scale of 1 to 100, scale of a 1 to 10, are we sinners in the hands of an angry God or good people in the hands of a loving God? Where do you score yourself? Why do you put yourself at that level? Can you really believe it? And then, of course, movement five is probably the image of God is one of the most defining things about our lives. It greatly shapes how we live our lives. What kind of a God are you going to bring into your life? How will it shape your life? What will you believe about God? What will you say about God? What will you do because of your faith in God? If you believe in God, what difference would that make? If you don't believe in God, what difference? So you bring them on into movement five. It's a very simple process. I was teaching a lesson, again, a demonstration lesson, I won't bore you with the details, on the great Muslim tradition of zakat. zakat is this extraordinary tradition that the Muslims have, is that you have to give 2.5% of your, not of your income, but of your assets to the poor every year. And again, you can imagine, you can start with a story, with an example of poverty, of people suffering. You can show a movie clip, YouTube, you know. You could start talking about hungers, the type of hungers, what kind of hungers. The ultimate primary hunger is for food. But then there's, after physical hunger, there's emotional hunger, spiritual hunger, personal hunger, hunger for love, hunger for recognition. All of us have hungers. What kind of hungers do you have? Where did you get them? Why is there hunger? Why is there so much hunger? You can use social analysis, statistics, you know, that so many babies die every minute in the world from malnutrition. You can have them reflect on why don't we feed the hungry? Because we could, if we wanted to. We could feed all the hungry in the world. And then you move into get them to do social analysis, critical thinking, their own positions on it, have them take their own positions. And you'll have people taking great varied positions. I think they should pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. Why should we be feeding the hungry? It's their own fault. You get all kinds of baloney if they're doing honest critical reflection. And the trust level does build in a group after a while. And you'll get people saying whatever's on their mind or in their heart. But then give them persuasive access to this rich Muslim tradition of giving 2.5%, and it's not out of philanthropy, it's out of a sense of stewardship. It's the whole notion that everything comes from Allah and we're only the stewards of it, and then once a year we have to give back 2.5% of it. And then bring them back into, well, what can we learn? Now, I'm not trying to make Muslims out of them, and yet I'm deeply inspired, I'm deeply confronted by that Muslim tradition. And what can I learn from it for my life? What does it remind me of? What does it inspire me to? How will I care? Movement 5, how will I care for the hungry and the downtrodden and the excluded and so on? It's an amazingly, I think, very user-friendly type, after you get into a mode of thinking for it. And very often, you'll go around and about in these movements. Like, you'll be in the middle of movement 3, and somebody will say something that they should have said back at movement 1. You say, oh, that's a great point. You don't say, oh, no, you're late, sorry. Or you do a bit of movement. Sometimes I use movement 3 as an engaging activity. My opening comments here this morning, I was borrowing from the third movement to do this, and then I asked you some movement 1 and 2 questions. I'm going to ask you some movement 4 and 5 questions in a moment. So you can mix them around and match them, and you'll often be here, and you go to there, and then go back to here, and then you go on to here, and then you go back to here, and then you go back to there. So I use the word movement very deliberately. It's more like a symphony. Or a dance, I suppose, than a lockstep. It's not a lockstep thing at all. Let me invite you. The topic I'm going to suggest, where do we see? Let's take the Blessed Trinity. Now, that's as tough a topic as any. I mean, that's profound, huh? Now, we'll only take about 15 minutes to do this, but you might get the flavor of it. This is definitely dating myself, but there was an old, and you may need your notepaper, your pad and paper, and I am going to have you turn to your neighbor for a minute or two, a few minutes. Years ago, the time of the dinosaurs, there was a singing group called the Beatles. And my favorite song they ever sang was, "What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love. It's the only thing that there's just too little of." Now, I didn't bring the song, I'd play it for you, but what do you think? Is there any truth in that? That the world needs now is love, sweet love, that is the only thing that there'll always be too little of. It could be true. But why don't you think of a person in your life that you love very deeply? And it could be your spouse, a parent, a child, a friend. Think of somebody in your life that you love with all your heart. And would you write down their name, whoever it might be? And even as you write their name, what kind of emotions well up in you? Just for a moment, recognize how you feel about this person that you love deeply. What sentiments, what feelings do they evoke from your heart? And if you wouldn't, if you'd be so kind, would you turn back to your neighbor and just for a couple of minutes, tell your neighbor, if you would, and if it's too personal, just be willing to listen to the neighbor. But turn to the neighbor, and if you can, tell them the story of this person that you love and what they evoke from your heart. Let's take 3 minutes, 4 minutes with a neighbor and have a chat about the love of your life. Or one of the loves, one of the loves of your life. Half another minute, we come back together. We'd love to hear from everybody, and of course you can't, but they'd love to hear from a few people. Just tell us the story, people you thought of in response to my question, how it made you feel, what you recognized, what you could see for yourself.
If you let me put your arm up or, you know, take your life for your child, you would in heartbeats do it.
Yes.
And that's me.
Is it marvelous? And it's a lovely imaging, because you favor the one that needs the favor, the one that's sick, the one that's away from home, the one that's rambling. That's how God is. You know, when you think of the image of the good shepherd, you say to yourself, now which lamb is the shepherd carrying? What would you say? The one that needs to be carried. The lame one, the stray one. And then when you don't need to be carried, the shepherd doesn't need to carry you. Yeah, but that lovely image of the mother's love, the father's love, when you favor the one that needs the favor. That's the kind of a God we have. That's how you got the heart you got. Another gift from somebody. You put up your, you just scratching your nose. Yeah, you just, don't even scratch your nose.
I have a very same situation. I have a little boy who is very same story.
But he needs a bit more love. That's the favorite image of God coming out of the Hebrew Scriptures, and of course in John chapter 10, he says, "I am the good shepherd." But when you look at that picture of the good shepherd carrying the sheep, it's the one who needs to be carried that gets carried. Yeah, so it's understandable that you reflect God's love. Yeah. So the Irish guilt takes over a bit too, but... Another story somebody had? Another love of your life?
Well, I'll share mine. Not that there's any story necessarily, but like that, I put down my children as well and struggled with who to put down. But for me, it was the feeling. You know, it was when you asked about what emotionally what comes up for you when you write their name.
Sure.
And it almost is beyond anything that you can write.
Yes,
or
of course.
Describe. Yeah. You know, that overwhelming feeling of love.
Yes.
And for me, that's what harks back to who God is, and that image of God is that you just can't contain it, and there is no way to express it that encompasses how it actually feels.
Yes.
And when I think of the people that I love in my life, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how I try and pour out that emotion that I feel for them when I talk about love, I have no real way to express it that in some way encapsulates all of what that is.
Indeed. Language fails. Yeah, we don't have the words. We can try to tell the story, but as you say, you've put it beautifully, that we fall short. And of course, as theologians, we always fall short talking about God. We don't have the language to talk about our own love. adequately. We sure as heck don't have enough language to talk about God's love adequately. We'll always fall short. Theologians are a profession doomed to failure, because we can never say all that needs to be said. You as teachers can never say all that needs to be said, just like you can never tell the whole story of your love for your children. But we have to try. Let me ask you a question. Why do you think we need to love? Isn't it kind of a nuisance in a way? Gets us caught into all kinds of commitments and challenges. And why do you think we need? Why do you think we need to love?
To get to put a bit of your own self, someplace else. I think when you are in love or in a loving relationship or love, you have to put yourself to the back seat and put somebody else before you.
Yeah.
You're not as concerned with your own stuff.
Yeah. And do you think that putting somebody else ahead of yourself, do you think it drags you up or drags you down?
It can do both.
It can do both, yeah.
Yes,
yes, and whether they reciprocate or not, and all of us will love people who don't love us, and so on. No, that can be terribly a burden. That can be a huge burden. Yeah. Anyone else? Why do you think we need to love?
The world would be a crap. You know, what would be the point? Like, you know, it would just be a world of suffering, really.
Great comment. Yeah. Yeah. It'd be hell. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what hell is. The absence of love, you know? Yeah, it would be a misery. So it's a fierce gamble, fierce risk, and yet it looks like we have to take it. Why do you think we have to take the gamble? What is it in us that disposes us, that requires us, that to live humanly, we have to live somehow in right and loving relationship? Or at least it's the best way to live, as you said, that to live otherwise is misery. It could be hell. So why can't we keep to ourselves and look out for number one and who cares about the other? Why do you think we need to be loving people, to live humanly? Wouldn't be better off without it. Why are we this way? Why do you think? It's like a higher power. It is beyond our control. Yeah, it is. It's like a higher power. There must be a higher power somewhere that maybe put this spark in us. All right. God is love, so I suppose if God made us. That.
The very act of our creation is from a loving act. So, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so I think you say you come from love.
You come from love. So how could we be otherwise? We're made out of love. We begin with the act of lovemaking. We're conceived in an act of love. And then...
I think we dispute that point.
Pardon?
Not for everybody.
Not for everybody.
Plenty of loving people who might have been created to an act of violence.
Oh, yes, indeed. No, good point. Good point. Good point. Thank you. That's a good caution. Yes, yes, no, good point.
And
good.
That's not like a violent situation, but it's a situation we're dealing with, particularly with our teenagers.
Sure.
Something we need to make.
Yes, indeed.
Well.
Yes, indeed. I suppose at its best, I was thinking about the act of lovemaking. Is that act of intimacy, as you say, but it can be violated, of course, and abused and be a dreadful violence. I suppose when it's not done out of love, that's when it's an ultimate violence. That's when it's an ultimate act of destruction rather than an act of love. Because it's perverted, because it's abused. That's a good entree into the movement three, that in a sense, in many ways you've said it all already, which doesn't surprise me, but this extraordinary dogma at the heart of Christian faith, that our God is a God of unconditional love, and is a three-way, constantly, the big theological word for it is circumcision. There's a three-way constant interaction of love within God's self, a three-way triune love. We traditionally call it Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. We can call it Mother, Redeemer, Sanctifier, Liberator. We've all kinds of names. But that even within God's self, God is this radical, total love, and always toward us, God is always this kind of a three-way expression of love in our lives. And we used to say, as Catholic Christians especially, we always said, the Blessed Trinity, you know, it's a mystery, you can't explain it. And it is a mystery, of course, and we've even talked about it here as a mystery. But it's not a mystery that we cannot explain. It's a mystery that explains everything. It explains everything about who we are and who our God is and how we're supposed to live. Because we're made in the image and likeness of this God of dynamic, constant, never-ending, unconditional love. And so made in that image and likeness, our very essence is to love and to be loved. And it's why he made it the greatest commandment, to love Lord God with all mind, heart, and strength, and one's neighbor as oneself. And as I said earlier, he couldn't have done otherwise. Because of the God that we have, and because of how we're made to love and be loved. And we couldn't be otherwise, because of this old dogma we talk about as the Blessed Trinity, this inner love of God always turned out toward us, because God's love has to turn outward. It can't be just simply between within the Trinity. It has to be an outreach, because it's true love. Supposing Christians were ever to take this nature of God, this unconditional love of God, this triune nature, this loving perichoresis of God, constantly circling, constantly reaching out to us, both within God's self and always toward us, this love, this radical, total, unconditional love. Suppose we were to take it seriously. Suppose you were really to say, hey, I'm going to try to believe that. I'll never quite get my head and heart around it, never completely this side of eternity, and yet I'm going to try to believe this unconditional love of God for me. Could you do it? Could you believe it? Can you believe it? And if you ever did believe it, even a little bit, what difference would it make? Would you write that down? What difference might it make to your life if we ever really did believe this love of God? And what would it invite you? What would it invite you to do? It might be just to deepen your belief. It could be to deepen your prayer. It could be to reach out in love. It could be anything and everything. It could be, but supposing you tried to, whatever conviction you're coming to, supposing you were to put it to work, what would it invite you to do by way of your own faith life? If you deepen even a little bit your awareness, experience, conviction of God's love. And would you mind sharing a gift with your neighbor before you go? Thank the neighbor for their good chat throughout the day. Give them a blessing, maybe. But if you're ready, when you're ready, as you're ready, have a share of what you were just coming to see for yourself and decide about God's love for your life. If you can, share it. If not, give each other a wink. So, 2-3 minutes, and we'll regather. The tempus always fugits. Just give us a little word, somebody, a reflection you had just simply on the exercise. In some ways, it was rather precursory and perfunctory, and yet, in a sense, we moved through all five movements. A reflection, maybe, or an insight, a wisdom, a decision somebody had, a gift for the rest of us. Well, whatever you bring away, blessings on that, and the little experience, I said, rather perfunctory and precursory, but you can get the flavor, at least, of the dynamic, I think, that might go on in a life-to-faith-to-life approach. What do you think of this life-to-faith-to-life approach? Agreements, reservations, additions? I've had all kinds of people over the hands that sounds great, but we couldn't do it in my school. Or we have to teach every day, or we have a whole curriculum to get covered. But I suppose, let me ask this question. So feel very free to respond to the notion of a life to faith to life, but also, what did you learn in school today? So let me take a minute and invite you to take another note from yourself. So when you go home now, somebody, your spouse or community member, friend, or whoever might say to you, well, was it any good? Oh, I was at the Abbey Hotel all day. Oh, this is a fellow from America. Was it any good? Well, yeah, it was a lot of the same old stuff, really. they say, yeah, but did you learn anything? Was there anything? What's the best thing you're taking away from today? What's the best insight? It could be something your neighbor said, somebody else said, maybe something, or something you knew already, and I help you remember it. What's the best gift, the best insight, the best wisdom? Because that's really what we're after, wisdom. What's the best spiritual wisdom you would take away from today? Write it down, would you? Because it's the most important note you'll take. And I'll give you a minute of silence or two to try to figure it out. And of course, you know, how will you put it to work? If you're to take it seriously, when you face back into that classroom tomorrow, what might have shifted for you, even a little bit? What might you do a little bit differently? Or maybe a little more deliberately, maybe good things you were doing already and you should redouble. You should redouble the effort there, that you were doing good stuff already. So go back to it with even more commitment or enthusiasm. So what difference will it make? Let me hear, we just have about 3 or 4 minutes left, then Justin has a couple of announcements. Let me hear a couple of reflections in response to these questions. That there's something you're taking away, that you come to see for yourself, that you're convinced of, and that you might put to work.
Do you know what I thought was nice about today was that we had a bit of time to reflect ourselves.
Great.
And it's something that I'd be conscious of, that, you know, and I presume lots of teachers would, that we're so hell-bent on getting the curriculum done.
Yeah.
And that we're not giving, well, I know I'm guilty, but not giving students time to reflect.
Great. So great point. Yeah. It's interesting, we always talk about getting it covered.
Yes.
Got to get stuff covered. And of course, that's what we do when we do too much. We cover it. We don't discover it or uncover it. Yeah. We cover it. But yeah, great point. That's a grand one.
I really like the idea of loving God, loving my neighbor, loving myself. And I hadn't really thought about loving yourself. It's, you know, you're actually loving God, that you should, especially young people, they should learn to love themselves.
To love themselves, because so many of them don't. Yeah, and they sin against themselves very often, hurt themselves and victimize, and you know, but how to get them to truly, it's a part of the law of God. Young people, when I tell them that, they're always surprised. The law of God is you should love yourself. But it is part of the law. It's a great one. Yourself.
Love God, St. Augustine, love God and do what you like, you know. And I think religion, life, our faith and everything is so simple. If we just, you know, trust in God. But today, Tom, after you, it's really reaffirmed that I just do not worry about anything now.
Great. Wonderful.
You know, God's love for us is so wonderful.
Yeah. Yourself.
Trisha's story. I take that with me about the boys and how they supported it.
The football team.
Yeah,
lovely. Yeah, wonderful. Marvelous. One more, one for the road.
The space when you're getting frustrated and feel that you can't pass the faith on, that it's not all up to us.
It's not all up to us. It's not all up to us at all. You do the best you can. And I want to leave you with that kind of thought, because I think I have an overhead that says it. But you're right, that the Spirit's at work through you as well. So it doesn't all depend on you at all. Now, you're a good partner in it all. And I go back to the Didache that we started out with this morning. Do the best you can. That's what we're all supposed to do. And it's God that gives the increase. God's love is always at high tide and gives the increase. A little bit of a commercial break. The Credo High School curriculum, take a look at it sometime. It's very American, so they're going to try to revise it actually for Irish schools, but some of the books are not that. American in the sense of examples and instances it gives. The book on the history of the church could be used anywhere. The book on social justice, I think, could be anywhere. So I think you may want to look at it. It's become a very popular series in the States. I think it has some potential here. And I suppose I want to leave you the image that God's love is always at high tide. All right. Blessings. Thank you so much. I've loved being with you. Thank you.